One day, making tracks in the prairie of Prax, came a north-going Zax and a south-going Zax. And it happened that both of them came to a place where they bumped. There they stood, foot to foot, face to face. "Look here now," the north-going Zax said. "I say, you're blocking my path, you're right in my way. I'm a north-going Zax, and I always go north. Get out of my way now, and let me go forth." "Who's in whose way?" snapped the south-going Zax. "I always go south, making south-going tracks. You're in my way, and I ask you to move and let me go south in my south-going groove." Then the north-going Zax puffed up his chest with pride. "I never," he said, "take a step to one side. And I'll prove to you that I won't change my ways if I have to keep standing here 59 days. And I'll prove to you," yelled the south-going Zax, "that I can stand here in the prairie of Prax for 59 years, for I live by a rule that I learned as a boy back in south-going school. Never budge. That's my rule. Never budge in the least, not an inch to the west, not an inch to the east. I'll stay here, not budging. I can and I will, if it makes you and me and the whole world stand still." Well, of course, the world didn't stand still. The world grew. In a couple of years, the new highway came through, and they built it right there over those two stubborn Zacks and left them there, standing, unbudge, in their tracks. I remember when I first heard this Dr. Seuss story, it was part of a video called The Sneetches and Other Stories. And I was just a little boy, and I always thought it was funny to see these two guys who were so intent on following their own stubborn idea that they weren't willing to move one step to the left or one step to the right. And one of the interesting things here is they weren't on a sidewalk, they weren't on a trail, they weren't on a path, they were in the middle of the desert, it looked like, from the movie that they showed. They're just two guys who happened to be walking and ran into each other. And some of you may have been in a situation similar to this, where you're walking down a hallway, or you're even here in the aisles in church, and you're walking, and normally we don't just stand there and butt heads with somebody, but you'll be walking towards somebody and you'll take a step to the left and they'll take a step to the right, so you almost wind up in a little bit of the dance there going down the aisle. And this is a funny idea of what would happen if people didn't give up on that. But the idea behind it is true, because, well, each one of us in some way is a little bit stubborn. It's part of our human nature, and I think it's also part of being an American. See, as Americans, we're guaranteed our freedom for so many things, and we tend to bristle and get defensive when someone tells us that we have to give up that freedom in any form. I think it's a big thing for us to realize that this is not always a bad thing. Giving up a little bit of our freedom isn't the worst thing in the world. Sometimes we don't recognize that there's some plan for our lives that maybe we don't understand. And if we keep trying to control our lives, that plan isn't going to ever come true. Sometimes we need to give up control in some little area of our life and give up our right to make every little decision. This can sort of be like following a trail through the wilderness. I don't know if any of you have ever been hiking or gone out someplace where you've never been before and had nothing to rely on, not even a map, except a trail. Because sometimes those trails aren't so easy to follow. Take, for example, while I was in Israel, I went on a trail like this. It was in the middle of the desert. It was at a place called Qumran. And you can see kind of what it was like here. Now, Qumran, if you've heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls, this is where they found these Dead Sea Scrolls, which are copies of books of the Old Testament that are thousands and thousands of years old. And we went to see this place where they found the scrolls, and also we wanted to hike up, which isn't really part of the tour, but we wanted to hike up and find the caves, like this one that you can see here, where they actually found these scrolls. And when we got there, neither of us had ever been there before, And we found out that there's a little kind of settled area, and then there's a trail that takes you up to these caves, which are not anywhere near the settled area. They were up in the mountains. And we decided that we were going to hike up into the mountains to find these caves, because we wanted to see what they were like. And it wasn't really an easy trail. You can see when I say we were hiking through the mountains, this is where we were hiking through the mountains. It wasn't the nice rolling hills that we have here. It was rock faces and cliffs, and it wasn't an easy trail to follow. And the only thing that we had to guide our way, there was no footpath, there was no little place where you could see footprints. We were probably the only people that had been up there in weeks. The only thing that they had to help you find your way were rocks, had little rectangles painted on them like a flag. They were about 3 inches by 5 inches, like an index card. And there was a blue stripe and a white stripe and a blue stripe. And what we'd do is we'd look for these markers on the trail. We'd walk along and we found one marker at the beginning. When you get to that marker, we would look around for the next marker. And that's how we knew where the trail went. If it wasn't for those markers, we would have had no idea where we were going. And if we wouldn't have looked for those markers and followed those markers, if we would have tried to make our own decision about, well, I think the trail goes this way. No, I think the trail goes this way. I'd probably still be in those mountains. Because after a while, when you've gone a couple miles, all those rocks start to look the same. And with the sun beating down on you, everything starts to look the same. So we had to depend on those markers. In the same way, we as Christians have markers in our life that we need to look for. Things that help us to stay on the right path, to stay on the right trail. We're going to talk about the trail today. And the first thing that we have to do if we're following that trail is we have to know the markers. We have to know those things that help us to find the trail, to help us stay on the path. And the first thing that I want to point out, the thing that I really want you to remember about these markers, is that these markers aren't the trail itself. When I went to Qumran and we went on this hike, I wasn't counting how many of these markers I could find. That wasn't my goal. It wasn't to find the markers. It was to find the caves and the things that were in the caves, not to find the markers. And as we read through this section in the book of 1 Peter, Peter's going to use a word here called that's submit. And it's a word that, like giving in and giving up our freedoms, makes us bristle a little bit. Something that we don't want to do. Something that we don't like to do. We don't want to submit. We don't want to give in to anything. But I think that Peter here isn't telling us that submission is our ultimate goal. Not the type of submission that he talks about here. Instead, they're markers along the path that help us stay going in the right direction, that help us follow the trail. In 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 13, he says, "Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every authority instituted among men, whether to the king as the supreme authority or to governors who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong on command and commend those who do right." Here, Peter is saying basically that we need to submit to the government. We need to submit to the laws that the government makes, the rules that we have to follow, the rules that the police tell us we have to follow. He also throws in there right in the middle, he says, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every authority. Now, it's very important here that we notice the reasons that Peter gives us to submit. We're going to look at each time that he says submit, we're going to look at the reasons that he gives us, because that helps us to know our main goal isn't submission. Our main goal is to serve the Lord, to stay on that trail. Submission is just a way that we can do that. It's a marker that helps us stay on the right path. Now, he says to submit for the Lord's sake. He doesn't say submit to the government because everything they do is right or because you like them so much. Because you're such a fan of the government and the way that they do things, you should submit to them. He doesn't say that at all. He says for the Lord's sake. One of the things that we have to keep in mind when we read this is that, well, the government today, you might disagree with them. You might disagree with some of the decisions they make or the way that they do certain things. When Peter wrote this letter, Nero was the emperor of Rome. And Nero's known for two things. The first thing he's known for is being a terrible leader. Rome, there was a huge fire in Rome when Nero was emperor, and the saying goes that Nero fiddled while Rome burned. Not a very good leader. When the main capital city of his empire is burning down, and he's not there working to stop it. The other thing Nero's known for is for persecuting Christians. He was big time into the lions and the Christians and putting them together to see what would happen. And this is who's in charge when Peter writes this letter. I'm guessing Peter wasn't too much a fan of the government. Nero was also in power later on when Peter met his end, when he was crucified. Again, not a big fan of the government. But he doesn't tell us this saying, your main goal is to submit to the government. He says, submit to the government because it's going to keep you on the right path. He says in verse 15, for it is God's will that by doing good you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish men. Why should we follow the government? Because if we don't, we're going to look like criminals, we're going to look like rebels or thieves. It's not going to be good for us as Christians if everyone is looking down on us for disobeying the government. It's just a marker to help us stay on the main trail. Next, right after that, Peter discusses slaves in the slaves that are members of the church. He says in verse 18, slaves, submit yourselves to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and considerate, but also to those who are harsh. Now, some people say that the slave-master relationship that they talk about here, we can relate these days to the worker and employer relationship. And in some ways that's true, but I think in general he's just talking still about people who are in authority over you. So it falls under the same category as one before. He's picking out a specific example here, something that happened quite a bit. A lot of the members of the early church at this time were slaves. And this was something that they had to deal with, being a slave to someone who was not a Christian. Not an easy thing to deal with. But Peter says, don't rebel, don't cause a big problem, do your job. And that way you can influence other people. Next, we're going to jump ahead a little bit because Peter goes off in a little bit different direction. But in the beginning of chapter 3, Peter addresses another one of those markers on the path, another place that we need to submit to stay on the path. Here he starts off by saying, in chapter 3, verse 1, he says, wives, in the same way, be submissive to your husbands. And again, he puts a motive in here. He says, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behaviors of their wives. In verse 7, he gives a similar command to husbands. He says, husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect. Again, he's not saying to women, your main goal in life is to submit to your husband. Not what he's saying at all. He's saying, your goal is to follow God. If you're not respecting your husband, if you're not listening to him, you're not going to be a good witness to him. You're not going to be following God the way that God wants you to. All you're going to be doing is making sure that your husband never gets any closer to God. If you're rebelling against him, he's going to look at you and see the church and say, I don't want any more of that problem in my life. I'm staying as far away from that place as possible. He says basically the same thing to husbands. He says, husbands, respect your wives. When Paul talks about it, he tells husbands to love their wives, like Christ loves the church. He wants us to submit to one another. He's talking specifically about our spouses, but we're going to look in a little bit where it's basically everyone that's here. We're supposed to submit to the government, to the authorities that are over us, so that that doesn't cause any problems, and we're supposed to submit to one another. Peter mentions both of these markers because they're vital in keeping us on the trail itself, on staying focused on the main goal. They're not meant themselves to be the end goal. Again, when I was hiking that trail, or when you're going somewhere, when you're hiking any trail, you're not looking for marks on the trees. That's not your main goal. Your main goal is to follow God. In the same way, our main goal is not to follow the government or to treat our spouses the right way. Those are things we need to do on the trail. But instead, they're things that help us to reach the main goal. And that main goal, of course, is submitting to God and having Him do with our lives what He wants to do instead of what we want to do. And in the middle of this, I said I'd come back to it, because in the middle of this, Peter gives an example of how to submit to God. He gives us actually the best example. He gives us Jesus Himself, and He uses this as an example. In verse 21, He says, "To this you were called, because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example, that you should follow in His steps. He committed no sin, and no deceit was found in His mouth. When they hurled insults at Him, He did not retaliate. When He suffered, He made no threats." Doesn't sound like a real fun time for Jesus there. When they hurled insults at Him, He did not retaliate. And when He suffered, He made no threats. If we choose to follow the trail, if we choose to submit to God, we should know that it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be just a walk in the park, which is kind of a pun since we're talking about hiking through the woods. But it's not going to be easy. And sometimes hiking isn't easy either. If we want to follow the trail of God, we're going to have to endure the hike, endure what God puts in front of us. And He never tells us this is easy. And if we look at the lives of Bible characters, we find out that it's not easy. You can't look and find a Bible character where he just gets good thing after good thing after good thing after good thing. There's none of them where that happens. All of them have problems that they have to go through. Good things happen to them as well, but all of them have problems that they have to go through, things that they have to endure, just like we do. Just like we do. So we have to endure. And John the Baptist does a great job of explaining to us how to do this. If we think of John the Baptist and what he went through, he started off before Jesus came on the scene. He was the preacher. He was the big-time guy. He was out in the wilderness, outside of the city, and thousands of people came to hear him. And he was very popular, and he came and they were baptized, and he kept saying, "I'm just getting you ready. I'm just getting you ready. I'm just getting you ready." And eventually, the time came when his time in the sun faded. And he knew that he had to step down, and I don't know if he knew what was going to happen to him. Because as we read on, we find out that John the Baptist was thrown in jail, and eventually he was beheaded. But John the Baptist says in John chapter 3, verse 30, he says, talking about Jesus, "He must become greater, I must become less." He must become greater, I must become less. When we're following God, there's going to be times when we're going to want to do one thing, God's going to want us to do another thing. When our hearts and our minds and our bodies say, "This would be really good right now. This would make me feel great. This would solve all of my problems." And on the other side, we know that that's not what God wants. You can think of the little angel and the little devil that sit on people's shoulders in the cartoons. And the angel says on one side, "Oh, this is what you need to do." And the devil says, "Oh, but this would be a lot more fun." He must become greater, I must become less. Following God, staying on this trail, means submitting in that way. Saying to the little devil, "Yeah, it might be more fun, but it's not right." And that would be for me, not for him. He must become greater, I must become less. And this is not an easy thing to do. We're grown up, we grow up, and we go through life, for the most part, looking out for ourselves, making sure that we're okay, then worrying about other people. Evolution teaches us that this is the way the world works. Natural selection, survival of the fittest. If I'm the biggest and I'm the strongest and I can take care of myself the best, then my offspring will be the best, and then the next generation will be more like me, and that's why the human race is as great as it is today. So to do this, to go against that thinking, that way that we were raised, the thing that we've been taught our whole lives, is not easy. It can be one of the hardest things. In fact, when Shakespeare wrote, in all of Shakespeare's stories, you'll find that if someone gets to that point where they become selfless, they love other people or another person more than they love themselves, they die. Go read any Shakespeare story. That's the way that he wrote. He just couldn't handle the idea that someone would get to the point where they love someone else more than themselves. Romeo and Juliet, perfect example. Romeo got to the point where he loved Juliet and worried about her well-being more than his own. Dead. Juliet, same thing. Hamlet, Othello, that's the way that Shakespeare wrote. It's not an easy thing, and there's only one way that we'll be able to do this. We have to trust our guide. In the second half of verse 23, Peter says, talking about Jesus, instead he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. Now, him who judges justly here is the Heavenly Father. Jesus trusted him so much that he was willing to go through all of these terrible things, all of these hardships. But that amount of trust, again, is something that's not easy for us. How many people here have ever been skiing? Snow skiing, downhill, alpine skiing. All right, think about what it means to be skiing. You're on two little pieces of fiberglass that are covered with wax on a big steep hill. And all that's around you is snow and ice. You've got two little poles and that's all you have to balance yourself. And you wind up going down the hill at speeds of 20 to 30 miles an hour sometimes. It's a very dangerous sport. Lots of people are injured skiing every year. Lots of famous people have died skiing due to skiing accidents. So I want you to picture yourself, it's a nice cold day, there's fresh powder out there. It would be a great day to go skiing. So I want you to picture yourself on the top of a ski slope, and you see the ground just drop out from under you, and you're ready to go down this hill. Picture yourself starting off, and you're going down this hill, you feel the wind hitting you in the face, there's fresh snow that's building up on your goggles, you hear people around you all over the place. I want you to picture that. Okay, now picture it blindfolded. Kind of gets scary, doesn't it? All of a sudden you're going down a hill and you can't see anything in front of you. I was talking with Carl this week and he mentioned to me that he has seen blind people skiing. So I decided, this sounds kind of interesting, and looked into it a little bit. And there's actually something called the ABSF, the American Blind Skiing Foundation. And what they do is they take people who are blind, who are either born blind or became blind later on, and they take them skiing. And this just blows my mind. I've been skiing, and it's hard enough when you can see. I couldn't imagine doing it without being able to see. And what they do is each skier is given a guide. And that guide teaches them how to ski, if they don't know. And at first, they'll be right there next to them, holding on to them. But after they get a little bit better, the guide just stays behind them and says, all right, now you're going to have to turn right. There's a bump coming up, turn left. The whole while going down the hill, not being able to know what's going on. Debbie Dickinson is a blind woman who, when she wrote this, was 43. She had been blind since she was 27. Wrote about her first experience skiing blind. And here she's learning to ski and then skiing with her guide, whose name was Michael. I want you to listen to the way that she talks about what happens and also the way she talks about Michael's voice, which is her only connection to Michael. She's just listening to him. She says, "I resolved that Michael's voice was clear, loud, and directive, and therefore all I had to do was focus on it. This meant using a tremendous amount of concentration in order that nothing else distract me. And that meant stilling my mind and praying. I couldn't help the rising feelings of apprehension as I noticed the unbelievable noise level and sounds such as I have not heard in 20 years, the last time I had skied." She could see then. "First, Michael fastened one ski to my boot and had me walk. Then he attached a ski to the other boot and had me walk some more until I felt familiar with the sensation of skis. Next, he showed me how to change to the other side from where I had been facing. This was done by holding my weight on the poles on one side and taking short steps behind the poles until I was facing the other way. After this, he was decided I was ready for the snow plow. To teach me this concept called the wedge, Michael skied a little way down the slope, turned around, and told Katie to push me. I went straight down and crashed into his arms, just like I was told. He asked, 'What is with the squinched up face and shut eyes?' Twice we did this routine until he declared it was time for the turns. At this point, figuring fear wasn't helping, I stopped worrying and thus began my crisscross down the slope. Flying down that ski slope, or so it seemed, I had to adapt very quickly to the changing terrain. No one was going to stop me, for I was not wearing any marker that said I was blind. Back at the ski school, Michael had pulled out a ragged, faded piece of cloth that was supposed to say blind skier, like the one that's over here. But it was so cold he could not even untie the strings holding it together. I wish that I could have carried my cane at least. The experience was ethereal. In my head, Michael's voice became amplified. I noticed my adrenaline was gone and my body seemed to disappear except for a point somewhere near my navel. It was wonderful. I felt like I was in a tunnel. The feeling was so strong the walls of that tunnel seemed tangible. I arrived at the bottom of the beginner's hill exhilarated, only to face the next challenge." It's interesting to see the way that Debbie's feeling about Michael's voice changes as her experience goes on. When she first starts off the story, she said that it took all of her energy to focus on hearing Michael's voice, her guide's voice. She had to focus everything she had on it. She even had to pray. This is from the American Blind Skiing Foundation, not the American Christian Blind Skiing Foundation. That's the only place that Debbie talked about God in the whole article. So I'm thinking that, you know, when she said she prayed, it wasn't something that she did about every little thing. It took all of her concentration. But as things went on, as she began to get to know Mike a little more and trust Mike a little more, after she skied down and she knew that he was going to be there to catch her a couple times, she started to trust him a little more, and it got easier to hear his voice. So much so that by the time she was done, she said that she could hear his voice and it was like she was in a tunnel. As long as she had his voice, she wasn't worried about going the wrong way left or the wrong way right, because she felt like she could almost reach out and touch the walls of this tunnel, because she learned to trust her guide. In the same way, we, if we want to stay on the trail, need to learn to trust our guide. And of course, our guide is God. Our guide is the King. We have the best guide out there. Jesus died on the cross, and when he ascended back into heaven afterwards, he sent us the gift of the Holy Spirit to be our guide. But we need to listen to him. And sometimes it can be hard. Sometimes, like Debbie said, it takes all of our effort to listen to the Holy Spirit and to trust him. But the more we do it, and the more times that we fall and he's there to catch us, the easier it's going to be to listen and to hear him. Peter gives us a couple road marks here And in verse 17, right in the middle of this, I think he gives us a good summary of what he's saying. In verse 17, he says, "Show proper respect to everyone. Love the brotherhood of believers. Fear God. Honor the king." And if you need to have a takeaway memory verse for this whole section, that would be it. Show proper respect to everyone. Love the brotherhood of believers. Fear God. Honor the king. It sums up the whole thing. And we need to remember that those things, respecting, fearing, honoring, loving, they're things that we need to do to stay on the trail. And sometimes we can get so focused on those that we forget about the trail. And that's not what Peter's saying. He's saying stay on the trail. But don't forget that those things are there to keep us on the trail. Jim's going to come forward and lead us in our closing song, "I Surrender All." And as we sing, I want you to think about your life on the trail. Are we getting stuck focusing on these things on the side? Are we ignoring those things and going off in a different direction, our own direction, when we should be looking at these things and following God? Think about these things this morning. What are you doing in your life to make sure that you're on the trail? And where are the places where you're kind of straying off the trail? Think about those things this week. Think about where it's important for you, what markers you need to look for, what markers you need to remember in order to stay on the trail.